Hey, this is Rob. This interview with Jenna St. John is from the Quarantine Archives of my Bespectacled Mofo channel. Link in the show notes. Jenna was lovely and gave us the inside track on something I believe to be an emerging frontier in this business, micro-budget TV writing. We may see some of these interviews again in video format as we ramp up season two of How to Make a Movie for $1,000. And if you're living in the future, that might already be a reality, so get over there and check things out. All right, enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another interview over here at Bespectacled Mofo. This is How to Make a Movie for $1,000 Season 2. And today I am joined by Jenna St. John, a friend of mine for a very long time, for a little change of pace. Because on this channel, we very much explore the ins and outs of filmmaking, feature filmmaking for the most part. But Jenna St. John is a low-budget TV filmmaker, and I feel like that has to be covered, and I've always wanted to explore this, so this gives me a chance to really pick her brain. Welcome to the show, Jenna St. John. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to schedule this out. You are the creator, the co-creator, because I know Sophie is also one of the creators as well, right?
She's a producer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But you are the sole writer of Sexpectations, the television show, which the pilot, correct me if I'm wrong, you made for $2,000, correct?
Correct.
I'm floored by this because it's a full-length pilot. It's like 30 minutes, right?
22 minutes.
Yeah, right in that space. But I'm like, you made a full-length pilot for $2,000, and it looks great, by the way.
Thanks.
It's fantastic. I've seen clips and things from it, and I was floored by the quality of it. And of course, your husband, Kevin Good, is the director. Mm-hmm. And I've always been an admirer of what you guys have been able to do on low budgets. Your feature film, now I'm blanking on that.
Dinner with the Alchemist.
Yes. The feature film, The Alchemist, which you guys did on $40,000. That was a $40,000 budget.
Right.
It looks like it was made for a lot more than that. Looks like it was made for hundreds of $1 million more than that. And the sort of technical know-how. And your husband has been very open on the internet about how you guys went through that process. But I'm just wondering, how did you do a TV pilot for $2,000?
So the pilot is the only one that costs that little.
Okay.
And so we did it, we shot over 3 days. So weekend, and we had an extra pickup day. Mm-hmm. Didn't pay anybody. so that'll keep costs down. So really the budget went to locations, food, all the things to take care of the people on set.
Was it
so
production?
Costumes. What's that?
Was it a SAG production?
It was.
Yeah, see, a lot of people get scared at that low budget level, be like, I don't know if I can do a SAG production. I'm like, yes, you can. You absolutely can.
Right. Yeah, it's doable. And SAG typically is pretty friendly if you get them on the phone and say, I need to figure out how to navigate this. There's usually a person that they'll designate to you that will hold your hand through the process.
Now, did you do it under new media or was it under a low budget agreement?
That was under, the pilot itself was under, everything was under new media. Mm-hmm. But because we shot them at different times, we had the pilot under one contract, episodes 2 and 3 under one contract, and then 4 through 6 under a different contract.
Okay.
But it was all under new media.
Now, did you do the pilot in sort of like as a proof of concept as to what the show could be and then hope to raise money for it or did you?
Kind of. I had the pilot written. I had few episodes written. But there's a few festivals out there that's really great for pilots. And so we just shot the pilot, thinking that we can submit it to some festivals. Hopefully it would gain some traction. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, let the thing fly. And so we shot it, produced it, whatever, submitted to some festivals, got into some festivals, had a really great audience reaction. And then I had this pitch session that one of the pilots or one of the festivals set up. Mm-hmm. And it went over pretty well. And this one random Amazon producer watched it a couple of times and wrote me back saying, you know, you're going to be okay. Like, you as a filmmaker will be fine. You just got to keep doing this. So then I did.
So you decided afterwards, like, you were like, on the strength of the pilot, you were just like, well, let's do the rest of them. Let's just, you know, go for a 6-episode first season.
You know, so we decided to do just 2 more and mm-hmm. just do 3 episodes and then call it done. And it felt, at the end of all that, it felt incomplete to me. Mm-hmm. So then we decided to do 3 more and do a 6-episode season, so I could at least have this complete piece to put out there, you know? And if lightning strikes, then somebody will watch it and say, I really want a season 2. Here's some funding. Right. Or, you know, can we license this or pick this up? And if not, then I have, you know, this full season of TV out there.
Well, where are you, what are your current plans for distribution, if you don't mind my asking?
So we're talking to a couple of different sales agents. Mm-hmm. For indie TV, with a bunch of unknowns, the pathways are pretty limited. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to get on like a network. So right now it's looking like the distribution outlets are Amazon, probably Tubi. And if we get lucky, maybe some cable.
Do you ever think about potentially putting like up an episode, like 1 episode for free on YouTube, and then like be like, if you like the rest, like, and then have a link at the bottom, like that kind of thing?
Yeah. We're talking about doing something like that, or like the first 3 episodes, mm-hmm. you know, for free. And then if they want to watch the rest of the season.
Yeah. That, because it very much is like the Wild West in terms of like independent television, because I feel like, and I think both you and your husband would agree with me, that the technology has come down so that you actually can produce like full like television shows like on your own. If you were able to pull together like the resources, you actually can put together something and be able to, well, distribution is, like you said, very limited, but at the same time, you are able to at least produce it to give yourself that fighting chance.
Absolutely.
And I think that's sort of like, that's my secret goal. That's the goal within my heart, is to be able to produce television up to the point. It's been the one, it is definitely my white whale. It is,
yeah,
it very much eluded me. And I do say, I can say sort of off topic, I really do miss our writer's rooms.
Me too.
Yeah. Jenna and I used to meet up with her husband and a few other folks, in this writer's room. And, it was super cool. I definitely have used those rules of the writer's room, like in other things and stuff like that, where I felt like, it was just a great mix of folks. And that's also where I met my de facto lawyer, Pam Nash. Shout out to Pam Nash, who's been sort of invaluable to me over the last few years and stuff like that. And now we're really good friends. But I do miss those writer's rooms. And I sort of miss that, because it did felt like the sort of camaraderie that I've always hoped for in that, in sort of a writer's room type of setting. But you are writing all these episodes by yourself. Talk about the challenge of that.
So to put a caveat on that, I write nothing alone.
Okay.
You know, I'll write something. I give it to my husband, Kevin. Mm-hmm. He reads everything a million times. And I have my group of writers mm-hmm. that I send it out to. Gabe Err, who is on the show, he plays the bartender Levi. He's another constant reader of mine who will give feedback. And he's a comedian, so he's really good at helping me punch up the jokes. But I rely on feedback. Mm-hmm. So to say that I write it alone doesn't feel fair.
Well, yeah. And there's also Sophie, who's the lead, and she's also a very big part of the process as a producer.
She is. She's huge. And, you know, and she kind of helped inspire all of it, you know, and I have to make sure that everything that I'm writing for her, she's comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So anything that I'm thinking about, I pitch to her first.
Well, can you talk about that, the premise of the show? Because it is a little bit raunchy, and that's kind of what I love about it. But can you sort of tell me what the genesis of the show was?
The genesis of the show?
Yeah, what?
Or
the show, well, so like, the yeah, what it's about and like where it's
the show is about Katie, who is an aspiring romance novelist, and she's getting her first book published. But the publishers tell her that her sex scenes read too G-rated. Mm-hmm. And so she needs to amp them up. We're in a post 50 Shades world here. But she's a virgin and she's extremely inexperienced. So she decides that she's going to lose her virginity for the sake of her book. And that's her,
fantastic.
You know, yeah, that's her season quest. And I think, you know, I think we're so used to seeing shows written in the male perspective, right, even if they're about women. Mm-hmm. And they just felt very inauthentic to us. And so we just kind of wanted to take control of the narrative.
Right. You also play her best friend, Victoria.
Yes.
And Victoria is, she's definitely sort of that out there, like Samantha-esque best friend type character. Mm-hmm. And like, I was wondering, do you, because you know it's you and like, you know, sort of where it's going, do you sort of find yourself giving yourself more like raunchier material? Just because you know, like, that's something that you know, you like, well, I can always count on myself, like that sort of thing.
I know that I have, so it's me and there is Sophia who mm-hmm. plays the lead. And so everything kind of goes to us.
Right.
You know, she takes on a big burden of the raunchy material.
Right.
And so I give her nothing that I wouldn't feel comfortable doing myself.
Right.
And I give myself nothing that I wouldn't feel comfortable asking of other actors, because we do have to bring on other talent onto this project. Mm-hmm. And so it is kind of this, you know, delicate dance of, you know, this is what we're asking you to do. Are you comfortable with this? So I write everything down.
Right.
I don't just say, oh, and then, you know, and then there's a hand job, or and then there's this, you know. I write down everything, so right, they know exactly how the scene's going to play.
Well, I think also the thing that helps is because it's essentially a comedy. Things are less towards like a dramatic side where it might turn into something else, where it's more funny, awkward, that sort of thing, where it can, well, I don't know. It seems like when I've done one, like when it's funny, awkward, it's people are already in on the joke, so it's easier to laugh. But in the other way, where you sort of have to have this intensity, but it's also dramatic, but it can feel like, all right, let's sit down and have a conversation about this and like work out exactly like where things are going to, like, sort of thing. It's the same sort of conversation, ironically, with horror, where you're like, where if you're having some sort of nudity or things like that in terms of horror, people seem more willing, or like, kill me dead, like that sort of thing. But you would do it in a different way, switch genres, and all of a sudden it's a different conversation.
Right. And so we have no nudity. Mm-hmm. That's like one line that we decide. We are asking so much of people,
right,
that we just put it out there. So there is this line here, you know? And yeah, I don't know. Everybody's different, and we would have actors come on where all they needed to do was a kiss. Mm-hmm. And they would express some apprehension about it. And it's like, oh, right, okay. So not everyone's on the same comfort level, and we have to have this conversation. Whereas like, I'm much more comfortable with that aspect of things than like holding a gun.
Right.
You know?
Right. Can you talk about something producible, like a TV pilot? What can someone do if like they're working with that sort of $1,000, $2,000 budget? What can they do to make something both producible yet looks like something that looks like it wasn't produced for $2,000? Like, what is the sort of alchemy of those two things?
I think the biggest thing that people need is time. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think you can write anything and make it happen. You know, you don't have to be confined to an apartment or to just 20 or 30 some year old actors. Mm-hmm. But you need time in order to set it up and make it look good.
Right.
You don't need an expensive camera. You don't need fancy lights, but you need time in order to set it up and to look at it and be like, okay, this is looking like a TV show.
Right.
Rather than just run and gun and shoot it, you know? I think rehearsing is important because you have so little time on set. Mm-hmm. To actually work with performances. So as much time in pre-production that you can to work with the actors, at least then performance wise, you're already there, mm-hmm. you know, and you're not bringing anyone out of it. In terms of, you know, a line feeling inauthentic or stilted. They're already well connected, the characters, and they have chemistry, and they know where they're at. But I think there are no limits.
Right.
You know, we it's a very heavy VFX show.
Yeah, you go through a lot of fantasy sequences.
Yeah. And... you know, I write the episodes as though there is no budget limitation.
Okay.
And then I give it to Kevin, and because he's our VFX guy as well. Mm-hmm. And he tells me what is doable and what isn't. And so far, there's nothing he hasn't been able to figure out.
Well, when you wrote the original pilot, was and then realizing that you guys were going to produce it, was there like was there a number of locations that you were like, okay, well, I know if I do like this amount of like locations, that like that pushes us farther, like that I should keep myself to this? Or were you thinking about future episodes where, you know, like this episode, this thing might not be might be easy to get once, but not necessarily again, like that type of thing? Because I know you guys have an entire bar. Like, how does that work?
So one of the benefits of being in LA is that we have these really great sound stages, mm-hmm. that are affordable. So you need a hospital, it's right there. You need a bar, it's right there. And so our bar set, we rented. That's part of where our $2,000 budget went to, was that bar set. So it's not a real bar.
Okay.
And for the other episodes, we just rented that same bar.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's definitely something my wife and I have sort of like talked about setting up for like a thing. There needs to be like a place I mean, there aren't a lot. I mean, you're talking about maybe Atlanta, but like not for most of the like East Coast and stuff like that, Upper East Coast, it doesn't seem like a lot of places where there's like places where you can rent stuff like that. And for it to be so cheap that you could do that, but you'd be there on a $2,000 budget, that's fantastic.
Right. And these places aren't, it isn't just the bar, you know, mm-hmm. you go around to the other side of the bar and that's a hospital. You mm-hmm. go to the other side of the hospital and there's a classroom. You know, so these sound stages figure out like what places are hard to find for filmmakers mm-hmm. and they just build them out. And they're booked out constantly.
Yeah. Did that also factor in to be like, if you like this place, like I know it has this location and that location and you like write to that within your script, or did that sort of come later?
A little bit. So in other episodes two and on, we have a character who's a hand surgeon. Mm-hmm. So he always shows up in the hospital set.
Okay.
You know, and so that was a part of it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, what occupation can we give him? You know?
So in terms of what do you think is the most important thing to get right in terms of low budget TV writing sort of filmmaking?
The script.
Okay.
I think if your script falls short, if it's not as good as it can possibly be, then nothing else matters, you know? And if you have a fantastic script that has all the turns and can keep people on the edge of their seats, then it doesn't matter. It can be animated. It can be stop motion. So I think that's the most important thing. The next important thing I think is sound.
Right.
So I think it has to sound good. Because I feel like crappy looking picture.
Yeah.
People can get past crappy sound. Is really hard to forgive. It becomes unbearable to sit through, you know?
Yeah, they always say sound is 70% of filmmaking. And I feel like a lot of us always skimp out on sound when we really shouldn't. It seems like, you know, and that I see those, I'm sure you've heard the same thing where you've had those productions where the director is also acting as a sound person and like all these other different things. And I can understand like director acting as your own camera person, but I feel mm-hmm. like you're acting as your own sound person. You're really doing yourself a disservice. It's just one of those things where it's like, you should have that dedicated sound person. Can only have a 3-person crew, one of those people should be sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's also, cause it's like, it's one of those specialized jobs that when you do look into getting a sound person, like, it's always super expensive. It's just like one of those things.
It is. Because you also need it. You have the person. You're also renting their equipment, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you said that you're hoping that like someone will come on and either license your show from you or perhaps like you would fund it in another way, but do you think independent TV is something that you would like go through again? Is there something else that you'd like to explore in this way?
Maybe, you know, I had this story in mind. When I wrote the pilot, I had written, I think 4 episodes at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always had the end in mind, like the end of the season in mind. It evolved, you know, as I went on, and hopefully for the better, we'll see. but, you know, like moving out to LA and trying to hack it out here as a screenwriter, you need all these samples. So you need your feature sample and you need your TV pilot sample and you need, you know, anything else that you might submit for.
Right.
And having Sex Expectations as a sample has worked really well for me. It has a good response. People laugh at the script, and producing it and having it out there doesn't prevent me from still using it as a sample.
Right.
You know, so I think just being a filmmaker and just wanting to put my work out there myself and being in charge of something, and not having somebody else come along and say, is this like, is the talking vagina face too much? Or is, you know, to just throw it all out there, is something I really want to do. Cause you know, Kevin and I making our feature Dinner with the Alchemist, mm-hmm. We had talked about doing another feature and we decided to just, let's just do a season of TV.
Right.
And see how it goes. Cause it is different. It's new. I know it's done, but I don't know anyone personally who has done it.
See, there aren't a lot of people, like I said, and I feel like, I personally feel like somebody's going to come along and pull a Rodriguez and, and I want to be that person so badly. I want to, like, somebody's going to come along with, like, I feel like the $50,000 television show where they've produced an entire season of TV that looks like, you know, like Scrubs or something like that, or something that, you know, we all know and love. It's going to be one of those things, and it's going to be, and then it's going to get picked up and licensed by one of the big three, like Amazon, Netflix, or Apple, or somebody. And like, it's going to jump over into that, like a feeding frenzy of like independent television. And then you'll start to see things open up. Cause there really isn't, I mean, you took it to a couple of different television festivals, but there still isn't a lot of like independent TV things like to like avenues to travel down.
No, there isn't. And like even writing a TV pilot is a bizarre thing because you're writing your own work, an original TV pilot, right, to go and try to get hired onto somebody else's, you know,
right.
That's the whole purpose of having a sample.
And it switched recently in recent years to be that, because it used to be, you used to write what were called spec scripts, where you would write something that was a sample from another show, like a Seinfeld or something that was currently on the air, something like that. But most of, it seems like TV writers or shows where, you know, they're asking for pilots, like they're asking for original pilots. So you have to have something like sort of there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I don't know. I very much am rooting for you, because I hope that somebody, even if it's not me, is going to make that first step and be that television show that everybody wants to emulate, that whole, because I feel like, and I think you and Kevin are doing a great job in that, showing that you can, do these projects on very small budgets, as long as you don't mind wearing a lot of hats and are able to use your resources. So what did you, I think I'm sort of asking this a different way. Was it when you wrote the original pilot, when you decided that you were going to produce the original pilot, did you know that there were certain things that, like what your resources were, in terms of how you were going to produce it? Like, did you sort of put those things down and like incorporate it, or were they just, it was just the mother of invention was the story itself, and you just did that when you just made that work?
The latter.
Okay.
So I write first, you know, I don't, typically I'm not like, okay, I have this house. All right, what can I set in this house? And I have these actors. I had Sophia, which is a huge piece of everything. You know, without her, like, Sexpectations would not be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, having my star, and my story, was kind of it. And then everything else, it was like, okay, so I have a bar. I need to find a bar. Let me hit up Google.
Right.
And that's how I discovered these sound stages in LA. I had no idea. Yeah. I thought I was going to have to like go find a legit bar. And so the first episode does feel pretty isolated besides the fantasy bits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the bar, there's their apartment, mm-hmm. which was a friend's apartment. You know, yeah.
Yeah, but it just, but eventually, like it, like past the pilot, like you were able to sort of evolve past that and that sort of thing. in terms of, well, I mean, you said that you're sort of going back and forth between it, but do you think that is there a potentially a business model where you feel like you could like continue to produce these sort of things, or is or are you just or is it just too early to tell at this point?
I think it's too early to tell. I know, so I don't know if you know Amazon filmmaker payout.
Yeah.
They like really cut it down. So when we first released Dinner with the Alchemist and we were actually seeing our quarterly payments come in, it was like, oh wow, and you know, this could be sustainable.
Right.
Then they sliced it and then they sliced it again. And it no longer feels sustainable through Amazon. And they're not the only avenue. So
Right.
we'll see. You know, I've heard that Tubi is fair. I've heard, you know, these other avenues could be better, but we'll see.
Well, that's sort of because the one thing that I've wanted and I'm sort of jealous of, or I don't know, because it's not necessarily, it's seen as one thing, but there's like the option of something like Patreon or OnlyFans where like you could potentially put like content up there and have like it not be bound by restrictions or things like that. Because the other thing is when you're putting things up on platforms, even Amazon, like they've had like purges where they come through and just like, we don't like this content, it's gone. And not give you a reason, and you can't re-upload it. There's no appeal process really, like, and then it's just like it's gone. And any revenue that you were seeing, like you can no longer make it. And it seems like an unfair rule where all of a sudden it's just like, well, okay, like you can have, you know, movies that feature people getting murdered and stabbed, but you know, all this, like, you know, like you said, like a talking vagina face would be like something like, oh, okay, we didn't like that. That's not cool. And I'm just, there's got to be some sort of platform where I feel like that's what we're missing is is an actual platform, like something that people can latch onto as independent filmmakers. Because YouTube has draconian rules and Amazon has draconian rules, and you never know when something will get striked or and then it's gone or you're banned and you just there's no appeals process. It's just the hammer of the powers that be came down and just decided that there and that's not sustainable in terms of a business model. You can't do that. You know, if you have bills to pay and things like that, it has to be something that you know that's in, you know, that's not going to destroy your entire livelihood, but just by someone coming down with a ban hammer.
Right. I do think it's, you know, it's important to be forthcoming, you know, so whatever banner or whatever you need to put in front of your, you know, your product is important. When I heard about Amazon pulling down content due to various issues that audience members were having, I was worried about Alchemist, but it never got pulled down. It hasn't yet, anyway. That stuff is more violent than like sex content, which I think people tend to be more open to violence. But yeah, we'll see. I think it's important to diversify. You know, you can't have your content all in one place. So you need to spread it out to as many avenues as possible. So if it does get pulled down from Amazon or YouTube or wherever, then you at least still have these, you know, select areas where it's still up. And even like, so we have Dinner with the Alchemist up on Vimeo for rental and purchase. Mm-hmm. Like every month there's something, you know, somebody has rented it from like Germany or some random place. And we put it up there because our family that lives overseas, mm-hmm. Was not able to get it through Amazon.
Really?
Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah, because it's up there for the UK and North America. So Kevin's family that lives in Brazil, mm-hmm. was not able to rent it or watch it through Amazon Brazil, I guess.
I know you guys had gone through an aggregator mm-hmm. for that. Did you, were you able to get it up on any VOD platforms besides Amazon?
You know, we didn't try. So we kind of went against their advice. Their advice was, let's put it up for transactional, and then, which is where it's only available for a rental or purchase.
Right.
And then open it up for a subscription, the streaming.
Yeah. SVOD.
Yeah. And we said, this isn't about money. This is about eyeballs. Right. So we want to just put it up for SVOD straight away.
Right.
And that's what we did. And for a while, before, you know, they slashed their payouts, it was working out pretty well for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I also think, I don't know, in terms of creating a business model, it's always going to be that comes back to that sort of dance of how much you're able to put out in order to have to recoup back
right.
in terms of payouts for wherever it sort of lands. And it is going to be one of those things. Like I was actually talking about this with my wife, Misha, where it even, you know, celebrities are having to have like multiple revenue streams. I mean, see the rise of Cameo, where people are
mm-hmm.
doing
right.
Like, you know, $300, you can get a birthday wish from James Vanderbeek, you know, like that sort of thing. But even celebrities are needed to diversify and have those sort of multiple streams coming out. So going forward, it is going to be, I guess, the same for us as well, where we're going to have to find these different streams. Would you consider something like a Patreon account or something where like you could be like ultimately funded by fans?
Maybe. You know, I'm not really familiar with Patreon. I've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel, I guess, too ignorant to to answer. Our approach has been, you know, and not that we have like money to throw around, we're just like not wise about it.
Right.
So we're like, whatever money we're comfortable losing,
right?
That's our budget. We have to assume that we'll never see this money again.
Okay.
You know, so everything, you know, making television shows or making shorts or features, it's all about, filling our bucket, filling mm-hmm. our souls, and working on our craft and just trying to get better, and also just creating demand.
Right.
You know, and kind of hoping that, you know, as if we're buying enough lottery tickets or raffle tickets over lottery tickets, that sounds better, that one day our number will be called and yes. we'll have our day in court, you know?
Yeah.
I'm using like a lot of metaphors here.
No. Like, I think I like the raffle metaphor. I definitely like that. You know, you buy as many tickets as you can, and you know, like there's a certain amount that you can, you know, based on how much money that you have, and then you're just hoping that that comes up and you win the big TV. Now I'm referencing my wife's family reunion. Every year they do that.
But yeah, that when opportunity does present itself, that you're ready.
Right.
And that's a big part of it too.
Well, I love the idea, like you said, the idea of being able to, because I've been through the development process myself on a television show, and I've gotten notes on my pilot, and you listen to people who have these wonderful ideas about your show, and, you know, especially when it deals with something like race, and they'll say something, and when you're dealing with white executives who have certain ideas about your show, and you go, you know, the thing is always say, okay, but, like, or okay, and, or like sort of trying to agree with them, but it's like, there's no okay, and that's racist. It's just, so trying to have a space where you could create and be able to sort of send your vision out there to the world, the same way that we do with independent film. I don't, like, there is a, you know, there are those, especially now, like, you're coming up, that you're seeing, like, auteur TV, where TV is written by one writer, or even if you could find, like, a way to have a sort of de facto writer's room for independent TV, if you were able to put that together, if people are all...
I would have loved a writer's room for his expectations.
Yeah, but, you know, there's, I don't see why, there seems to be some sort of, like, there seems to be a sort of, like, shadow or, like, a negativity to, like, doing independent TV versus doing independent film. Maybe it's because independent film is so essentially established, and we're definitely still in the wild, wild west of independent TV. But there seems to be some sort of, like some sort of mark where it's just like, oh, wait, you're doing that? Like, and it's sort of less than, because people think of TV in this completely different way than I feel like they do independent films. And I'm not sure.
Yeah. I think doing, like, a complete, you know, full 22-minute episodes for 6 episodes feels a little crazy. And it is, where for independent features, there's a process and an avenue out there for them. But there isn't that for television.
Right. There's so many things that you can, that are avenues and stuff like that. Even as as the rise of, in terms of this channel, I was embraced when I did Barbara, that was embraced by the mobile community, where it was like, people were coming up and they were like, yes, we're making more movies on phones. We are making movies on phones. There is an entire movement. There is an entire avenue. There are entire film festivals. There are entire, like, branding and marketing. Like, literally they did a whole thing where major companies, it was LumaFusion and I think Filmic Pro, like, descended on the Computer Electronic Expo in Las Vegas. Like, they bought out a whole section and was like, we're making movies on phones. Everybody jump on board. Like, get on board, because we're all making movies on phones. And there's nothing like that, really, I feel like, for independent TV. People aren't, like,
I don't think it's for a lack of desire. Hopefully, you know, maybe there will be, like, a Duplass Brothers for television coming up. Maybe it'll be me. I don't know.
I hope
it won't be me.
I hope because I already know you, and that's good
for me. But, you know, a big drive to make the show was because it's the show that I wanted to watch.
Right.
Absolutely. You know? And so I think if you are like, oh, where is this show on television? I keep waiting and waiting, and, oh, this sounds similar. Oh no, this isn't hitting the mark.
Right.
Then you should make it.
You know? Like, that's where we are. We're like in sort of the era of where Netflix has led us to this niche content where you can literally zero down on, like, the type of show that you want to see. I feel like that's perfect for where we want to be. So if you have that story inside you, like you said, where you don't feel like you're getting served and you don't feel like you've ever seen yourself on television, it's a perfect time to tell that story. And so I am so glad to see you tell yours, and I hope that you continue to find ways of making it happen. And I can't wait for Sexpectations to be put out. I'm waiting for all six episodes myself, because I did read some of the scripts and they were fantastic.
Thank you.
So where can folks find you online, Jenna St. John? Where can they find you?
I'm on Instagram, just the at Jenna St. John, and on Twitter as well. That's kind of it. I have a private Facebook account, but I'm hoping for the day where I feel confident enough to hit delete on that thing. but Instagram and Twitter is where I am most active.
Okay. Is there a forthcoming website for Sexpectations?
Sexpectations is also on Instagram. It's at Sexpectations TV, I believe. Let me look that up really quick before I steer you wrong. Yeah, Sexpectations TV.
Okay, and there'll be, I'll put a link down to that in the show notes.
Perfect, thank you.
So, Jenna St. John, thank you so much for this interview. You've been lovely with your time. I know you have an injured husband and a baby. So thank you so much for giving me your time and your audience. And I really appreciate reconnecting. And I hope that you are the Duplass Brothers of independent television. I really do. That would be great.
That would be awesome. And thanks for having me. It's always great talking to you.
Yeah. We'll have to, I don't know when you and Kevin are coming back this way, but anytime you do, we'll have to get together, us and Pam, and get together.
Yes. Whenever we get the...
Yeah. Where everybody's supposed to be eligible soon, hopefully.
But I'll be hitting refresh trying to sign up for that first slot.
I don't know what the world's going to look like after this. Like, I was literally watching a Tom Cruise movie. I was watching Mission Impossible 3, and Tom Cruise walks into a 7-Eleven and he's not wearing a mask. And I was like, oof, like, what is this? You know what I mean? And I wonder, like, are we just going to go back to like a non-maskless world? It seems weird to me, because like, we went through flu season. I haven't caught anything. You know why? Because I wore a mask every day.
Yeah. I personally feel like it'll be a long time before I'm comfortable with a lot, like sitting in a movie theater and eating popcorn. But I think there's huge pockets of people that are just so eager for any kind of normalcy.
Seafloor.
They're like, restaurants are open. I'm going to order a Diet Coke. Oh, you know?
Yeah.
Where I'm comfortable taking my time getting there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, yeah. But then again, like I said, I don't know if we're necessarily going to, like, I wear mine at work. I don't know that I'm going to stop wearing my mask.
Right.
But then again, I work but that's a whole nother thing. But like, I don't know that there are places now where I will go without a mask. Like, you know, I just don't feel like the stigma of it is gone. That's the word I was looking for earlier, stigma. I feel like the stigma behind wearing a mask in a public place, because you used to see them at the airport. Like, you go and you would be traveling by airport and you see somebody with a mask, and you'd always be like, who's that weirdo? But now, like, everybody's wearing a mask. So I feel like in those kind of places where you're like, man, there are a lot of, I need to be wearing my mask, you know, like that type of thing. Like, I just feel like that's
right.
Masks are actually here to stay.
I hope so. I think they could do a lot of good.
Yeah.
In the very beginning, a year ago, at the beginning of the pandemic, when nobody was wearing a mask, we were wearing masks. I had family in Korea, like, send me boxes of masks. And they were like, the Korean masks are better. And they were at that point, because everyone was just like recommending bandanas or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, you know, my kid wears a mask to preschool. They all have like their little fitted masks on every day. And it's like weird to think that this whole pandemic has been a third of his life.
Right. I didn't even think about that. You're raising a child in an era where masks are a thing. Like that's
right.
And they'll grow, your kid will grow up. A lot of people's children will grow up not having that same sort of stigmatized look at masks. So just be like, oh, okay, I've got to put up my mask on. Like, that's not going to be a thing for them.
Right, right.
Whereas for us, like, we had to come to that. And our generation is sort of pushing the other side of 30, like those people.
I'm on the wrong side of 30 too.
Yeah, we are definitely on the wrong side of 30. thank you so much for coming on, and like I said, we'll have to get together soon, but I appreciate so much you sharing your advice and your experiences with us.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.